insights from parameterized field theory.
Okay, thanks, Jorge. So this is an account of work done with Alok Latra, who's now a postdoc at Penn State. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So let's turn to page 2. The talk is based on a recent paper which we put out on the archive. And the formalism is developed in a couple of other older papers. And I'd also like to bring to your notice a recent paper by Thomas, which touches on some of the same issues which I will be talking about now. Let me go to page 3. And I will start the talk with a brief summary of the dynamics in LQG, the state of the art. So for this talk, I will restrict attention to canonical theory. In canonical LQG, there is a key open question which has to do with the construction of the Hamiltonian constraint operator. The construction of the Hamiltonian constraint involves infinitely many ad hoc choices, and therefore the definition of the quantum dynamics is far from unique. Why does this happen? This happens because the Hamiltonian constraint is a local expression, and therefore it's constructed out of local fields. However, in the polymer representation one uses, local field operators are simply not definable. And the basic operators are non-local and have a very discontinuous action. In such a situation, one proceeds as follows. One tries to do what one does in lattice gauge theory. So one fixes a triangulation of the spatial manifold and constructs a finite triangulation approximant to the Hamiltonian constraint, which agrees with the Hamiltonian constraint in the limit when the triangulation becomes infinitely fine. Then one replaces the various phase space functions in this finite triangulation approximant by the corresponding operators and gets an operator at finite triangulation, and then attempts to take the continuum limit of this operator. The problem is that the continuum limit, which is the limit of this operator in infinitely fine triangulation, depends on the choices one makes at finite triangulation, and this in turn can be traced to the discontinuous nature of the polymer representation. On the other hand, the very consistency of the quantum dynamics requires an anomaly-free representation of the constraint algebra. So a natural question is, can one fix the ambiguities in the definition of the Hamiltonian constraint by this requirement? Namely, if one considers the Poisson bracket of two Hamiltonian constraints, this gives us a Diffeo constraint, and one could require that the particular definition of the Hamiltonian constraint, which is the correct one, is one which yields an anomaly-free representation of this particular Poisson bracket. The problem with this is that for all the choices which we have currently, the constraint algebra consistently trivializes. So both the left-hand side, which is the commutator of the Hamiltonian constraints, as well as the operator corresponding to the right-hand side, both vanish. And so what can one do in such a case? One thing one can do is to look for toy models, which may be able to help us, and parameterized field theory, which I refer to as PFT, is one such toy model. And the question is, well, can parameterized field theory help in providing clues to what to do in LQG? And what I hope to convince you in this talk is that parameterized field theory indeed does help. And it helps because the detailed structure is uncannily similar to LQG. And of course it helps because it's a solvable model and one knows all the right answers, so one can be guided to the right choices. So more in detail, I will be considering parameterized field theory in two dimensions, and hence it's a generally covariant theory, and it has two constraints. I call them H plus and H minus, and these constraints form a Lie algebra, and therefore it turns out that one can solve them completely unambiguously without recourse to any triangulations, by group averaging techniques. Then one can consider classically equivalent constraints, which look like a Hamiltonian constraint and a diffeomorphism constraint. And these constraints form a Dirac algebra, which is isomorphic to that of gravity. One can then do as an LQG, which is first take off from the same polymer kinematics and first diffeoaverage, and then try and construct a Hamiltonian constraint, but be guided in this by the fact that one already knows what the right solutions are. And if one does all this, then this analysis yields suggestions for what to do in LQG, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. One is that it suggests that one should tailor the representation of the regulating holonomies to the edge labels of the states which are being acted upon. A second example is that one should perhaps look beyond finite smear density 1 operators to higher density operators. There are the structural similarity with LQG is so much that I think there are lots of other things to learn. Let me now go to page 5, where I give you the plan of the talk. So what I will do first is I will give a review of classical and quantum parameterized field theory. Then, so this will take a large chunk of my talk because most people are not familiar with this. I will then move to the construction of the Hamiltonian constraint following the seminal work of Thomas in LQG. I will then turn attention to the quantum constraint algebra for PST and show that it trivializes consistently, just as for LQG, both with respect to the so-called Riemann uniform Rovelli-Smolin topology, as well as on the Lewandowski-Marolf habitat. I will then argue that this trivialization suggests that one use higher density Hamiltonian constraints. And finally, I don't know whether I'll have time to do this, but I will show you that there is a new habitat, different from the Lewandowski-Marolf habitat, which actually supports a non-trivial representation of these higher density constraints. And then I will discuss the results vis-a-vis LQG. Let me now go to page 6 and talk about classical parametrized field theory. So parametrized field theory is just free scalar field theory on a flat background fixed space-time written in generally covariant disguise. So dynamically, it's just completely equivalent to free scalar field theory on a flat background. How does one get the action for PST? One starts with the free scalar field action. So S0F, and over here the capital X are Minkowskian coordinates. Eta AB is a minus plus metric. I will be in two dimensions in this talk. And F is the matter field. The next step is to parameterize the inertial coordinates in terms of some arbitrary coordinates and feed this back into the action. And so what one has is just the free scalar field action, but written in arbitrary coordinates. So nothing new really has been done here. And for example, the new components of the flat metric are just given in terms of derivatives of the inertial coordinate. So now I do something new. I consider this very same action not only as a functional of the scalar field F, but also as a functional of two new scalar fields which correspond to these Minkowskian coordinates. So in this action, I'm going to vary not only F, but also capital X and capital T. When I vary F, keeping capital X and capital T fixed, then obviously what I get is just the free scalar field equation, once again, in these arbitrary coordinates, little x and little t. And therefore, I can solve this, and I can just transit to the coordinates capital X in this particular equation, and I can solve little f as a function of capital X and capital T. If I vary capital X and capital T, I find that there are no new equations, and therefore what is undetermined is the dependence of capital X and capital T on little x and little t. So there are two functions worth of gauge, and this simply corresponds to the two-dimensional general covariance of the action because of our arbitrary choice of little x and t coordinates. Now let me go to the Hamiltonian theory. So because this is has two-dimensional general covariance, there are two constraints. And before I go in more detail, I'd just like to remark that the free scalar field solutions on a flat background in two dimensions are just a linear combination of left and right movers. And I will be using this split into left and right movers to motivate certain variable choices in the Hamiltonian theory. So let me now go to page 6, which is the Hamiltonian description. So capital C and capital X now become canonical variables. And in accordance with the remark I just made, I'm going to use light cone variables, X, capital X plus and capital X minus. The phase space is the scalar field and its conjugate momentum, and the light cone coordinates and their conjugate momenta. I have two constraints, which I call H plus and H minus. And if you notice, the combination of matter fields which occur is always phi s plus s prime or phi s minus s prime. So this motivates that we define two new matter fields. These are just new coordinates on the matter phase space, which are the y plus minus equal to phi s plus minus s prime. And one can check that y plus and y minus commute, and y plus and y plus and y minus with y minus give you some derivative of a delta function. So the plus and minus vectors now no longer talk to each other. And in particular, h plus with h minus is 0. And the Poisson bracket algebra is non-trivial only because h plus and h plus and h minus do not Poisson commute. What happens is that, for example, for smeared, a Poisson bracket between two smeared h pluses gives you exactly something isomorphic to the Lie algebra between two vector fields, two spatial vector fields. In other words, the Poisson bracket algebra between the smeared H pluses is isomorphic to the Lie algebra of spatial diffeomorphisms of this Cauchy, of the Cauchy slice. And the same is true for the minus algebra. Since H plus and H minus generate evolution, evolution is really equivalent in this case to two independent spatial diffeomorphisms. Finally, one can gauge fix and one can choose little t and little x to match with our Minkowskian coordinates. And if one does this, this process is called deparametrization. One can feed things back into the action and get back, as expected, just the standard flat space-time free scalar field action. The capital X and capital T variables have a nice geometric interpretation, and that is what I will turn to on page 8. So on the left, we have the spatial manifold with some coordinate little x. And on the right, we have the space-time. So supposing I fix some value of little x, the embedding, the canonical data, capital X and capital T, furnish me with a point in the flat space-time, namely x of x and t of x. And if I let x run along the spatial slice, what I generate in the space-time is a spatial slice embedded in space-time, and therefore these variables are called embedding variables. And what I haven't shown you over here, but what is true, is that the pullback of the space-time metric to this slice is a spatial metric, and the spatial metric is basically x plus prime times x minus prime. And so as we go along, we'll see these factors of x plus prime and x minus prime occurring in various expressions. So let me now go to page 9. And here I sketch the relation between the Hamiltonian theory and the space-time solutions. So on the first diagram on the left, one has the Cauchy slice and Cauchy data, x plus minus and y plus minus. You take a finite canonical transformation generated by the constraints, and this gives new data, x plus minus nu and y plus minus nu. On the right-hand side, I have the space-time. And x plus minus and x plus minus nu give me two Cauchy slices in the space-time, sigma and sigma nu. Given the data, given the slice sigma, y plus minus actually gives me matter data on this slice. And I can evolve this matter data in the entire space-time using the box s equal to 0 flat space-time scalar field equation. I can do this, and then from the solution, I can induce new data on this Cauchy slice x plus, given by x plus minus nu, and this exactly matches with y plus minus nu. So this story is also true for parameterized field theory in any dimension. What happens in two dimensions is something quite nice, which is that the evolution from y plus x plus to y plus mu x plus mu is actually equivalent action of a spatial diffeomorphism phi plus on the data. And similarly, for the minus fields, an independent diffeomorphism phi minus. Just to give you a very brief plausibility argument, go to the third diagram. So here I have the solution of the flat space time solution, which is left movers and right movers. And let me just restrict to the left moving part, which is the flux field. Let me be given this data, x plus minus and x plus minus mu. So I have two Cauchy slices in this flat space time. And these red dots indicate how f plus evolves. So I can go to the new slice and I can look at a point little x, and the value of f plus at that point little x is the same as the value of f plus on the Cauchy slice, on the old Cauchy slice, but now at the point phi plus of little x. And since all these Cauchy slices are diffeomorphic to each other, when you put things together you get exactly the conclusion that diffeomorphisms are equivalent to evolution. And this is what we'll use to solve the model. So let me now go to page 10, where I give you a couple of cautionary remarks, or basically just one. What I'm going to do is I'm going to set the space-time topology to be that of a cylinder. So space is going to be a circle. And I do this because not much is known regarding the polynomial representation when space is non-compact, because then one has to introduce boundary conditions, etc. Now, it is convenient to use angular coordinates, both on the spatial Cauchy slice, as well as on the Minkowski space-time circles. Right? So the inertial spatial coordinate on Minkowski space-time will be chosen to be an angular coordinate, as will the coordinate little x on sigma. And because I'm using a single chart on the circle, I have to be careful about identifications of little x and capital X modulo 2 pi. And while this is trivial in the classical theory, in the quantum theory one has to be a bit careful, but one can be careful and take care of this, and I will only mention what happens when required. Let me now go to page 11. So this was the classical part. So is there any questions? I can take them. Okay, so there are no questions. Let me now go to the quantum part. So let me first focus on the embedding sector, and let me just look at the plus part, because the minus part follows in complete analogy. So for the polynomial representation, I need holonomies, and here holonomies are going to be labeled by colored graphs. What is a graph? A graph is just a set of edges which covers the circle. The analog of spin, just a label, Ke for each edge, E. And a holonomy is then constructed by exponentiating I times summation over the edges, Ke integral of pi plus over the edge, E. The electric field variable, like the triad, is the embedding variable itself, x plus of x. And the Poisson bracket between the electric field and the holonomy just pulls out a factor of Ke whenever little x is inside the edge E. So this is very similar to just what one would do for U1 theory. Let me then go to page 12. The representation is spanned by a charge network basis. The charge network is, again, I'm not explicitly putting the plus superscripts. The charge network basis is labeled by a graph and a set of labels K, one for each edge of the graph. And so I've drawn a graph with five edges and these five labels. And the collection of labels I'm going to denote with a vector. So K vector just denotes a collection of edge labels. The embedding variable x hat just acts by multiplication. So whenever little x is inside some edge E, it pulls out a factor of h bar KE. The holonomy acts by translation. If one takes a holonomy based on some graph, and one takes a state based on some other graph, one can of course go to a finer graph than both these. And then all that happens is that the embedding charges of the holonomy and the state are added edgewise.
The inner product is just the usual conical delta inner product. A very key and important point is that the range of k is integer value. So h bar k is proportional, some integer multiple of a parameter a, which has the dimension length. And a is like a Barbero invariancy parameter, the theory, because for any particular fixed value of a, one can check that the phase space functions separate points in phase space. However, this a also appears in the spectrum because of the x hat operator. And different values of a give different spectra, so you get a labeling of unitarily inequivalent polymer representation. The same thing is true for the minus vector. So let me now go to page 13, where I will construct the kinematic Hilbert space, first the matter vector, and then the kinematic Hilbert space. So for the matter sector, just due to lack of time, I won't discuss in detail what happens. One can define holonomies and a representation on matter charge networks. A charge network is again a colored graph with some matter charges, which are again integer values. And the kinematical Hilbert space is obtained as a product of the plus and the minus embedding and the matter sectors. So that is what I write explicitly on page 14. So H kinematic is a product of H plus and H minus, and each of H plus and H minus are spanned by charge network state. And of course, I can choose a fine enough graph so that the embedding charge networks and the matter charge networks live on the same graph. And if I do this, then every edge of the charge network is labeled by a pair, an embedding charge and a matter charge. And this is true for the plus and the minus sector. What about the action of gauge transformation? So again, let me concentrate on the plus. Recall that H plus, the constraint H plus, essentially generated one set of spatial diffeomorphisms, as did H minus, an independent set. And H plus and H minus don't toggle each other. So if I look at the plus vector, and a finite gauge transformation simply acts essentially like a diffeomorphism. So phi plus here is a diffeomorphism, and u hat phi plus is just the unit reaction of this diffeomorphism on a charge network state. And so I draw it, let's consider the charge network with three edges, in orange, green, and purple. And let me consider a diffeo which moves you along the circle in an anti-clockwise fashion. The arrows just move along with the edges because the matter fields are periodic and well-defined functions on the circle. However, the embedding charges basically almost move along with the edges, except whenever an edge crosses little x equal to 0, you get an augmentation by some factor of 2 pi. So basically, the takeaway lesson is that things move by diffeo, and because of the fact that one is using angular coordinates on the circle, one has to put in these factors of 2 pi, but you needn't worry about that too much. So let me now go to 15, wherein I construct the physical state, Hilbert space. So since gauge transformations are just diffeos, a plus diffeo and a minus diffeo, it's easy to repeat what one does for spatial diffeomorphisms in N2G and construct physical states simply by group averaging with respect to these a plus and minus diffeo. So in other words, the group average of a charge net, which is a plus cross minus charge net, is a distribution which is represented by a sum over all distinct gauge-related charge nets. And that's what I've written in the second line. It turns out that there is a very nice geometrical interpretation, both for a charge net as well as for its group average, and that is what I indicate on page 16. Go to page 16. Let me consider a charge net, which is a plus cross minus charge net. And let me consider the graph gamma plus and gamma minus to be the same. I can always go to a fine enough graph to do that. Then every edge of such a graph has two embedding labels, a k plus and a k minus. And recall that these k plus and k minus are just eigenvalues of the x hat and x hat plus and x hat minus operators. So one generates from such a charge net, a set of k plus k minus ordered pairs, one for each edge of the charge network, and one can plot these in the Minkowski spacetime with x plus equal to k plus and x minus equal to k minus. And one gets a set of points, a finite number of points, for each charge net. The edges of each charge net are also labeled by two matter charges, L plus and L minus, and therefore one can associate with each such point an L plus and an L minus. So the resulting picture is that one has the analog of a discrete Cauchy slice with some discrete matter data on it. If one takes a gauge transformation of this state with phi plus and phi minus, then one simply gets a new discrete Cauchy slice and new matter data on it. What happens with a group average? Well, a group average is a sum over all gauge related images of a particular charge net. So one can take an element of this sum, which is a bra, and one can consider the quadruples, k plus k minus, l plus l minus, for each of its edges, and then one can take all the charge nets in this sum and consider quadruples for each of them, and one gets a big set, which one can plot in space-time, and therefore a group average of a charge net, it turns out, is in correspondence with a discrete space-time and matter on that discrete space-time. And the nice thing over here is that this association is consistent, by which I mean that if any charge net provides me a pair k plus and k minus and matter l plus l minus, and if there is a second distinct charge net which also provides me the embedding data k plus k minus, it will also provide exactly the same matter data l plus l minus. And this can be traced to the fact that the algebra, the group of finite gauge transformations has been represented correctly in the space-time, which is ultimately a reflection of the fact that the constraint algebra has been taken care of correctly. Okay, so this ends my review. And if there are any questions, I can take them now. Okay. So there are no questions. I go now to the meat of the talk on page 17. So we have the physical state space. And we would now like to do as one does in LQG, namely, not analyze the constraints H plus and H minus, but combinations which correspond to C diff and C Hamiltonian. So what I will do is I will first construct solutions to C diff, which is just H plus plus H minus, by group averaging with respect to spatial diffuse. So we start with the same polymer kinematics, but now group average with respect to spatial diffeomorphisms. Then I will try to construct C-ham. C-ham is just H plus minus H minus divided by that factor, which is just the square root of the determinant of the induced spatial metric on the embedded. So one would now like to define the Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation, find its continuum limit on diffeomorphism invariant states, and then evaluate its commutator and check for anomalies. So let me go now to the spatial diffeomorphism averaging. C diff is just H plus plus H minus. And remember that H plus and H minus commute. And therefore, for finite diffeomorphism, one can check that C diff actually generates spatial diffeomorphisms of the various fields. And therefore, a finite diffeomorphism over here corresponds to a gauge transformation in which phi plus is equal to phi minus. This just comes about because the diffeomorphism constraint is H plus plus H minus. Now, this automatically means that the physical states we constructed by averaging over all gauge transformations are automatically spatially diffeomorphism invariant, because spatial diffeomorphisms are just particular examples of these general gauge transformations. So more in detail, a diff average of a charge net can be written exactly as an LQG, as the sum over all its distinct spatially diffeomorphic images, and that is the sum which I have written down. What about the interpretation of this in terms of the discrete space-time picture? It turns out that two states which are related by the action of a spatial diffeomorphism define exactly the same discrete slice and the same matter data on this slice. Therefore, a disaverage is in correspondence with a single discrete Cauchy slice and data on it. This automatically can be used to show that the physical states we constructed, while they are diffeomorphism invariant, they are not normalizable in the space, in the Hilbert space of diffeomorphism invariant states. And just roughly, yes, was there a question? Yes.
I'm a little confused about density weights. So
yes.
Hamiltonian
yes.
has a density weight 1, but the diffeomorphism does not. What is happening to the density weights, please?
Yes. So in one spatial dimension, you have a correspondence between density weight objects and covectors and vector fields. So C diff, which is actually a covector, can also be interpreted as a scalar of density weight 2. The Hamiltonian constraint then is H plus minus H minus divided by a density weight 1, and so the Hamiltonian constraint is density weight 1.
Yes, so it is unusual to have the diffeomorphism constraint to have density weight 2, isn't it? LQG.
Certainly. I mean, there one does not have a ready correspondence because you have distinct objects which are vector fields, and scalars and vector fields are just different objects. Whereas here, you can convert a scalar with certain density weight to a vector field. So that will not happen in LQG, certainly. But maybe we can, if you say, I can say something about this at the end of the talk, maybe. Maybe there's a way to use the one-dimensional nature of the graphs to actually create some sort of a correspondence. This is just a fuzzy remark. May I continue?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So let me see. So I was just going to state that since diffeomorphic states are just a single discrete slice, whereas physical states are a whole space-time, which actually is a sum over infinitely many such slices, one can turn this into a proof that physical states are not normalizable in the diffeomorphic Hilbert space. So let me now go to the Hamiltonian constraint on page 18. And here, what one would like to do is to construct the Hamiltonian constraint. And it turns out that it suffers, again, from a lot of ambiguities. But here, one can be guided by the fact that we have the correct solution space. And so the question which we would like to address over here is, can we construct the Hamiltonian constraint operator in such a way that it kills physical states that we have just constructed by group averaging over both the plus and the minus case transformation? So let me first define, as an LQG, a la Thomas, the finite triangulation, Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation. So we consider a charge network state, S plus S minus, and here I've just changed the notation to make it a little simpler. Each of S plus and S minus stands for the triplet, which is the graph and the embedding charges and the matter charges. So this is just a charge network state. And as an LQG, I will choose a state-dependent triangulation of the circle so that every vertex of the state is going to be a vertex of T. And further, I'm going to choose T in such a way that the coordinate length of every edge is equal and equal to delta. And I can think of T as well as a graph because of in one dimension, just the one cell can be each one cell can be identified with an edge, and then you have a bunch of vertices. Okay, so one is we choose this state-dependent triangulation, and now the Hamiltonian constraint has two parts. One is the square root of the determinant part, and the other is the h plus plus h minus part. So let me deal first with the square root of the determinant part. And just as an LQG, one can first consider the classical 1 over square root of the determinant and obtain it as a Poisson bracket of embedding holonomies with the spatial volume. I will not sketch in detail how this is how this is done, but one can then convert, one can write down an operator for the spatial volume and construct a volume operator and replace the Poisson brackets by commutators. And finally, the resulting operator is such that it acts non-trivially only at vertices of the state, very similar but not identical in some sense to what happens in LQG. And moreover, at finite triangulation, these are just diagonal, it's a diagonal action, so the charge networks are eigenstates of this operator, and the eigenvalue can be split into a product of two parts. One is lambda of V, and this lambda is simply constructed out of various combinations of the embedding charges at the vertex V, and then there is an overall factor delta, which arises because of the density weight of the object, and this factor is the exact analog of a similar factor in LQG when one considers the undensitized triad operator. As a final remark, one has to be a bit careful in defining this inverse volume operator, and one needs to be careful that it does not kill states with zero volume. Otherwise, all these states would also lie in the kernel of the Hamiltonian constraint, and that would be too large. It turns out much larger than the set of physical states we have just constructed. But one can do this. One can actually take care of things properly. So let me now go to the more interesting operator, which is the H plus plus H minus. So let me turn to page 19. So I just call the combination H plus minus H minus as H. And it turns out that H is pi plus X plus prime minus pi minus X minus prime plus some matter terms. Just as the Diffie-Hellman constraint was H plus plus H minus, and it generated a gauge transformation of a particular sort, H over here, one can easily check, generates a gauge transformation with phi plus equal to phi minus inverse. So in the diffeomorphism case, it was phi plus equal to phi minus. Here, we have phi plus equal to phi minus inverse due to that minus sign. The unitary representation of any finite gauge transformation, we know is the unitary representation of these finite gauge transformations is not weakly continuous on the polymer Hilbert space. And H is the generator of such gauge, of some particular class of these gauge transformations. So how could we possibly define this generator as an operator? And here, this is, I think, a key idea. The key idea is that one is interested, first, in finite triangulation. And so at finite triangulation, what one wants to do is to write down the operator in such a way that it is a finite gauge transformation minus the identity. So I want a result wherein I get a unitary operator corresponding to a finite gauge transformation, a finite but small gauge transformation minus 1. So let me illustrate what I mean by focusing on the first term, which is a pi plus x plus prime term. Let me go to first the x plus prime operator at finite triangulation. So let it act on this charge network S plus S minus. Now, what X hat plus does is it simply, as I said, it takes out a factor of K. And a little bit of thought, I think it should make it clear that what happens is you get a difference of two embedding charges of the edges which are around the vertex X or the point little x. So you take a the point little x on the charge network and you look at the charge which emanates from it and which terminates on it, and you take its difference, and that will be, roughly speaking, the action of the difference of x hat plus at two nearby points. And then, of course, we have to divide by delta because we have an x hat plus prime. And so clearly, if this point little x is not a non-trivial vertex of the graph, one gets a vanishing action. Whereas if it is a non-trivial vertex in the right diagram, then one gets a factor k2 minus k1. Let me now turn to the pi operator. The pi operator is on page 20. And pi hat is not well defined as an operator. It's only the holonomy is well defined. And therefore, what one would like to do is to write phi at finite elevation as some edge holonomy minus 1 divided by delta. And I also want that the final expression should have something to do with a small finite gauge transformation. So let me inquire as to what a small finite gauge transformation does on a charge network state. So consider a small gauge transformation, which is labeled by the diffeomorphism phi v delta. So what is phi v delta? Phi v delta is a diffeomorphism which is identity at all vertices of, at all non-trivial vertices of the charge network state, except the vertex v and its vicinity. And it maps the vertex v to v plus delta, where delta is the length of each cell of the triangulation. So there is an edge, which is capital delta between of the triangulation between v and v plus little delta, and phi v delta maps v to v plus delta. And as a result, if one started off with the situation at the top, where one has a green edge terminating at v and a red edge starting at v, then the end result is that this green edge extends to v plus little delta at the cost of the red edge. On the other hand, one can consider the following holonomy, which is e to the I k1 minus k2 integral of pi plus over this particular edge of the triangulation, capital delta, and its action on the charge network state. So what it does is that it will simply add the charge k1 minus k2 to whatever are the prevailing charges on the edge capital delta, which is between v and v plus little delta. That particular edge is labeled is red, and so it's labeled by k2, and so one just adds k2 plus k1 minus k2, which just gives me k1, and therefore one has the identical action as for what phi v delta does. So this immediately suggests that we define the holonomy, we define the embedding momentum pi plus t in terms of this holonomy, and that's what I do. So this is just e to the minus in our notation delta vk is just k2 minus k1 around the vertex v, integral of pi plus over the edge capital delta minus 1, and then one has to of course divide by the factors in the exponent. One factor of little delta because one is integrating, and then a factor of delta vk. And if one now puts everything together, so pi plus x plus pi at finite triangulation, finally various factors of little delta combined, you get a little delta square, again in accordance with the density weights. And more importantly, you get something which is proportional to the action of a diffeomorphism or a gauge transformation minus 1, and the subscript e just says that I'm, for now, in this transparency, I've restricted attention only to the embedding part of the charge network. So I think here there's an important lesson for LQG, which is one should open one's mind to the possibility of tuning the representation of these holonomies to the edge labels. And as is known, there is an ambiguity in the regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint, as pointed out by Alejandro Perez. And so one possible answer from PST about the J representation of the holonomies is that one needs to really consider the edge labels of the states, and this is reminiscent qualitatively, but I think not in more detail, with what happens in the Neubauer prescription for LQC. Let me now go to page 21, where we consider the rest of the terms in the Hamiltonian constraint. So recall again that H is pi plus x plus prime minus pi minus x minus prime plus some matter. And the Hamiltonian constraint is H divided by square root of the determinant. One can do similar things as I've done for the embedding variable. And finally, one can write down an expression for H at finite triangulation such that it is proportional to the action of a gauge transformation minus 1. On the plus sector, the gauge transformation is labeled by the diffeo phi v of delta. On the minus sector, because of that minus sign, in the first expression, h equal to pi plus x prime minus pi minus x prime, one has phi v minus delta, And again, phi d minus delta is a diffeome, which is identity at all vertices of the charge net except v, and moves v to v minus delta instead of v plus delta. Then you have a factor of delta squared in the denominator due to the density weight. The determinant of the metric square root gives you another factor of delta in the numerator. If one wants to consider the smear Hamiltonian constraint, one has an integral which gives you yet another factor of delta. So that finally, the smear Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation, all the factors of delta cancel as expected for a density weight 1 operator, and one gets a finite operator just as in LQG. And the nice thing which happens now is that this kills all our physical states at all finite triangulation. One can now take the continuum limit on a Riemann. So consider, let psi be some spatially diffeomorphism invariant state. One can take the action of psi, which is a distribution, on the state, which is the Hamiltonian constraint operator at finite triangulation acting on a charge net. So one will get a number which is dependent on delta, and one can take the limit of this as delta goes to zero. This is some finite answer. It exists exactly as an LQG. And as I'll comment later on, one has to again interpret the continuum limit in terms of the uniform to very small in topology. So one can also show that in this continuum limit, just as an LQG, the commutator between two Hamiltonian constraints vanish. And now one needs to turn to the right-hand side of this Poisson bracket relation. The two Hamiltonians give you a diffeome. So let me now consider the spatial diffeomorphism operator. So for that, we go to 22. So the diffeomorphism constraint is just sum. Is there a question?
Is the Hamiltonian operator you have constructed, is it self-adjoint?
No, it is not self-adjoint. Since this was the first try, we did not try and construct a self-adjoint operator. And also because of Karol Kukács's statements, we thought that maybe it's not relevant to construct a self-adjoint operator. But certainly it is not self-adjoint.
Okay. But the second question is it that the kernel of this Hamiltonian is precisely the solutions you found before, or is it that the kernel is much larger and the solutions you found before are a part of it?
Yes. So almost, I think almost 100, again, this is, there are so many questions that we didn't analyze this in any detail, but I think it's almost sort of, you know, I'm almost completely sure that the only solutions are the solutions which we have constructed.
Thank you.
But of course, the joint ones, I mean the Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism constraint, of course. So what I meant to say was the joint kernel of the Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism constraints would be the physical state space. That is, I'm almost sure they have not demonstrated this. Okay, so now let me go to the disk constraint. And again, exactly sort of similar things give us at finite triangulation, the action of the diffeomorphism constraint, which is a plus plus minus gauge transformation, labeled now by the same phi v of delta as expected. So what one gets is the action of a spatial diffeomorphism minus the identity divided by delta squared. And if one smears it with some C number vector field and takes the resulting thing at finite triangulation, one only gets the factor of an integral dx, which cancels out one of the deltas, and there is a remaining delta inverse there, and the resulting operator is clearly then not a finite operator. However, the right-hand side does not have a C number shift. Its shift is actually constructed out of the lapses and a factor of the contravariant metric. And when you put this factor in, you get an additional factor of delta squared. So that the right-hand side operator at finite triangulation is proportional to a diffeomorphism, a unitary operator with a diffeomorphism minus 1, and then there is an overall factor of delta. And one can take the delta going to 0 limit on diffeomorphism invariant states, and this will vanish, and vanish what I call vanishing doubly. So first, it vanishes because there is an overall factor of delta. And secondly, because diffeomorphism invariant states are killed by the diffeomorphism minus 1. And this is exactly the same structure in LQG. So Thomas has beautifully defined in his first paper the C before beta for LQG. There's a candidate definition which one can polish up, and really it's exactly the same structure which is there. Okay, so to summarize, basically, if one looks at density weight 1 constraints and a la theorem, one gets a consistent trivialization of the constraint algebra, just as for LQG. Let me now transit to the Lewandowski-Marolf habitat on page 23. So note that the Hamiltonian constraint itself, the smeared one, is not different-variant because of the presence of this lattice. And therefore, the corresponding operator does not map different-variant states to different-variant states. So the continuum limit, which I wrote down in the last slide, has to be interpreted appropriately because one is, although different variant states are used to define the continuum limit, the operator itself does not map the space of different variant states to different variant states. Note, however, that apart from the lattice, the Hamiltonian constraint really is different variant. I mean, it's almost different variant. It's discovariant. And therefore, the Hamiltonian constraint, in some sense, almost maps these different variant states to different variant states, apart from these factors of n, which come at the vertices of the state. So Udek and Don construct a space of almost different variant distributions, on which the continuum limit of the Hamiltonian constraint can directly be taken. In other words, one can take a continuum limit in such a way that you get an operator, which is a genuine operator on this vector space of almost different variant distributions, and this space is called the LN Lewandowski-Marolf habitat. So let me define it. So let us consider first the charge network state S plus S minus, and let us look at all its non-trivial vertices. So there are non-trivial vertices, n of them, say, V1 to Vn on the circle. Let me then consider a function of these n vertices, that is, a complex valued smooth function of n copies of the circle. Let me also introduce a little more notation. Let me call the spatial diffeomorphism class of the state to be the square bracketed S plus S minus. Okay, so given the structure, one can define a basis for the habitat state, which I write down as the distribution psi sub S with subscripts F and S plus S minus square bracket. And that is simply equal to a sum over all diffeo images of the original charge net S plus S minus weighted with the function F, which is evaluated at the vertices of the charge network stated multipliers. That is F of phi V1 to phi Vn. And this distribution is a basis, and so the habitat is the finite span of such distribution. Since F really are mapping some vertices, and they're smooth, they're called vertex smooth functions. And in particular, if F was just a constant function, I would simply get a sum over diff images of the state, and that would just be the group average diff invariant state. Okay, so now let me turn to page 24. So the first statement is simply an elaboration of the statement that the Hamiltonian constraint maps states in the habitat to states in the habitat. So consider a state in the habitat psi f. Take the Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation, which I've written down, act it upon some arbitrary charge net s plus prime s minus prime. So you get some number which is dependent on delta. Take the limit delta going to 0 of this number, and what you'll find is that it agrees with another number, which is simply the action of a set of habitat states, the combination of them, psi of gi, acting on the state S plus prime, S minus prime. So the operator is fine and acts on the habitat. There's a continuum limit in the habitat. One can now directly compute the commutator of these two smeared Hamiltonian constraints and show exactly like in LQG that it vanishes. Then one can consider the right-hand side also, which is C therefore beta, and show that that vanishes too in the on the habitat. And again, it vanishes doubly. First, due to the overall factor of delta, which I pointed out. And second, also due to the u hat this minus 1, because of this u hat this minus 1, it turns out that one obtains a difference of evaluations of the vertex smooth function f at points on s1 to the n, which are separated by delta. So it consistently trivializes also on the LM habitat, just like in LQG. This leads to a natural question. Can one get a non-trivial action on the right-hand side if somehow one could put in an extra factor of delta to the minus 2? Why delta to the minus 2? 1 delta to the minus 1 to cancel the overall delta, and 1 delta to the minus 1 to convert this difference of functions at nearby points into a derivative. The answer is yes. And to see what happens, let me make a small digression and consider not C diff beta, but C diff smeared by a C number vector field. So that's what I do on page 25. So recall that C has this at finite triangulation smeared with the vector field was just proportional to u hat this minus identity and divided by this factor of little delta. One can take this operator and consider its action on the habitat, take its continuum limit, delta going to 0, and what one finds is one gets another habitat state smeared by a function g, and this g is really just the Lie derivative of f with respect to the vector field n. In other words, this operator, which is not a finite operator, gives you exactly what you want on the habitat. One can compute the commutator two diffeomorphisms, two C diffs, and one finds that one gets a faithful representation of the Poisson bracket algebra. So I think an important lesson for LQG is that one should now really be open to a consideration of operators which do not necessarily have a finite action on the kinematic Hilbert space. Now, let me turn back to the question we started out with, which was the right-hand side. How can we get these two extra factors of delta inverse in the commutator between two Hamiltonian constraints in PST? The answer is simple. You scale each of the Hamiltonian constraints by 1 over delta, and that you can do by multiplying Hamiltonian constraint by square root of the determinant of the metric. So you use a density 2 Hamiltonian constraint instead of density 1 Hamiltonian constraint. And if you just compute the Poisson bracket algebra, you find that you get a diffeomorphism constraint, which is smeared by a C number vector field. It's constructed out of the lattices, but now remember that the lattices are density weight minus 1, and it turns out that in one dimension, a density weight minus 1 scalar is also a vector. So one gets exactly what I've written down over there. However, due to this extra factor delta inverse, the continuum limit of H on the habitat is not defined. It just blows up. And one can check that its commutator is also ill-defined on the habitat. So there is, whereas the right-hand side is perfectly well-defined, and defined, I think, correctly, so therefore there is an anomaly on this habitat. And I can say more about this. There is really an anomaly on this habitat. And therefore, it's a bit puzzling because we try to make all the right choices and get the right solution space, but yet somehow this anomaly shows up. So what is happening? I don't know how I'm doing for time. So either I can just sort of go to the discussion or discuss the construction of the new habitat.
Why don't you continue for a few minutes more?
Okay, so what happens is that there is actually a new habitat which one can define where all these problems go away. So let me turn to page 26 to give you a quick definition of that new habitat. So recall, now let's go back. We recall that H plus and H minus generate actions of phi plus and phi minus, which are just diffeomorphisms on the phase space. So H plus and H minus are really like a pair of diffeomorphism generators. And I've already shown you how C diff can be represented very nicely on the LM habitat. So what one can try and do is define a habitat for the plus vector and one for the minus vector, which are LM type habitats. In other words, for the plus vector, one can consider all the plus images of some charge network state S plus with vertices Vi plus and weight it with some vertex smooth function on the plus vector only. And one can easily see, one can do it just doing what I've done before, one can easily see that the smeared Hamiltonian H plus of M plus simply acts exactly by taking the function f to its Lie derivative with respect to the vector field m. Again, density weight minus 1 lapse is equivalent to a vector field. Also, as I've shown for the diffeomorphism constraint, similarly what happens here is one can get a faithful representation of H plus with H plus, because this is just the algebra of diffeomorphisms, the algebra of vector fields. So one gets, and so one can do the same thing for minus, the minus vector, and then simply take the product. So nu plus minus is just nu plus nu minus. And since the plus and minus vectors commute, and because the density weight 2 constraint H is just a simple combination H plus minus H minus with no phase space dependent factors, it's just plain H plus minus H minus. Since C diff is just H plus plus H minus, it follows that H and C diff also one can get an anomaly representation of. So in the end, one can use all these techniques and find that everything is fine. One can define this new habitat. One can get a non-trivial representation of the density weight 2 constraint algebra. And also one can show that if one wants to find the kernel of the constraints in the new habitat, they are exactly the set of physical states we started off with. So that ends my talk. I will just now move to the discussion section. And again, I've split it into two parts. I will just first give you the first three main points, and then you can stop me if I'm going over time. So what are the sort of three takeaway lessons which one may will learn, or at least consider these PST ideas to consider for loop quantum gravity? One is to consider the possibility of allowing representations of the holonomies at finite triangulation to be state dependent. The second, for me at least, the insight is that the lack of weak continuity of operators on the kinematic Hilbert is not necessarily a hindrance to the definition of their generators on some appropriate space of distributions through the mechanisms of finite triangulation and continuum limit of dual action. And finally, and maybe most importantly, and I don't know whether how valid this would be for LQG, but just sticking my neck out, certainly this happens for PST. The choice of density weight 1 constraints really hides the underlying non-triviality of the constraint algebra. So in some sense, the feeling I get is that if one uses density weight 1 constraints and one says that the algebra is consistent because it trivializes, I think this is somehow a very legal kind of bylaw by which one is getting away. I think there is a non-trivial constraint algebra, and one is just hiding it by dealing with these density 1 constraints. And perhaps one should look at a choice of more singular operators of higher density weight to probe the structure of the constraint algebra. So of course, now the key issue, so this is basically what I wanted to say, and now I'll go on with the discussion, or you can stop me whenever. So the key issue is, can we handle the algebra of higher density constraints in LQG? And of course, the answer is I don't know, but let me make a few comments about this. So let me, for this discussion, call the commutator of two Hamiltonian constraints to be the left-hand side, and the operator corresponding to the Poisson bracket between them to be the right-hand side. So let me first concentrate on the right-hand side on page 28. So what happens in PST for the density 1 case for the right-hand side? The right-hand side vanishes both in Anathema in the uniform for very small in topology, as well as on the Lewandowski model habitat. In LQG, the density weight 1 constraints, the results are exactly the same as for PST, and as shown by Thiemann, Lewandowski, Marolf, Gambini, and Pullen. And in PST, however, the density 2 constraints, when you use them, the right-hand side is a diffeomorphism constraints near by C number vector field, And this is not kinematically finite, but nevertheless is well defined on the LM habitat. So this gives a natural question. Can we define the diffeomorphism constraint smeared with a C number shift in LQG? So one can quickly try and do this, and one can check that the operator at finite triangulation is not finite exactly by this one power of delta inverse as in CST. So the question is it definable on the Lewandowski-Marolf habitat? More precisely, does there exist a definition of the Ostecker-Barger curvature at finite triangulation such that in the continuum limit, the diffeomorphism constraint, the smear diffeomorphism constraint is defined on the habitat, the LM habitat, and such that its commutator algebra is isomorphic to the Lie algebra of vector fields? And it really looks like the answer may be yes, and this is work in progress with Alok. And again, the definition of the curvature is very, very far away from what one usually uses. The leading order term is that which one uses normally, but then there are all these terms which depend on the triad and which also probe the label, the J label of the state, etc., etc. There are some loose ends to tie up, but hopefully everything works properly. Let me now go to the left-hand side on page 29, where I have almost nothing to say. Of course, the question is for the right-hand side to have, this is just a sort of a naive first start on what one would like to think about for the left-hand side. So the right-hand side to have a net factor of delta inverse, as for the diffeomorphism constraint, how should we rescale the Hamiltonian constraint in LQG? And the answer is one can just check that one would need to rescale it by modulus on subtleties by q to the 1 over 6. That gives you a factor of delta inverse for each Hamiltonian constraint. However, again, the rescale constraints, just like in PST, are not well defined on the LM habitat. And so really the key question is how do we look for a new habitat? And I didn't tell you because there was no time. There is a related habitat in the PST scenario, which is which we call a zero volume habitat, which is somehow some cousin of the Lewandowski-Marolf habitat. And the question is there an analog of that in LQG? Finally, these authors, Gambini, Lewandowski, Marolf, and Pullin, rescale the Hamiltonian constraints by hand, just by hand, in LQG. And they show that there is no way to get a diffeomorphism from their commutator unless the Hamiltonian constraint actually moves vertices around. And again, I think the work with Alok will hopefully feed into a better definition of the curvature, and at least give us a start in this. So I think that's the end of my talk. Thank you.
So, Madhavan, Thomas Thiemann apologizes for not being able to call because he had a meeting, but he's then...
Yeah, I'm here. I'm actually here.
So. Oh, you're there. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, sorry, I missed three quarters of the talk because I just came from a hiring committee. I wanted to just add some comments, but maybe they are redundant because maybe you have answered these questions already. But let me just start by saying that I'm extremely supportive and of this work that you have done with Alok, and I find it very beautiful and really, think, open some new paths. And what I wanted to comment on is just since you mentioned that there was a paper by myself also, which was completely independent work. The two of us have worked parallel to each other without knowing of each other. Yes. So my comments just want to point out some overlaps and some differences. So
yes,
I just want to throw this into the round. So first, a general comment about the using of this URST topology. The way I use it is just in order to somehow justify why it's possible, why it's okay to somehow consider finite triangulations and not taking the limit. So the operators that I define using this argument, using this topology, is just operators which somehow attach loops in the usual way without taking the limits. And if you do it this way, then you always deal with operators which are density weight 1 and which are such that that the commutators of two Hamiltonians doesn't vanish on the kinematical Hilbert space. The paper that I have written is written in that spirit, which leads to some differences which I come to in a second. From the technical implementation of the constraints themselves, I think we almost completely agree with each other as far as could be. I haven't read your paper completely yet because I came out only on Friday, but it seems to me that there's almost total agreement, except maybe for one thing, which is that the way you define the constraints is by choosing the labels of the holonomy approximants according to the space. And I think that can be slightly improved because it can be shown that you can define an operator more in the spirit of improved loop quantum cosmology, where those labels somehow are chosen by an operator. But this is a minor technical comment. Let me come to the most important thing now, which is that you seem to very much explore this path of defining density weight two operators, which are not defined on the kinematical Hilbert space. And I think this is the biggest difference between our papers. In my paper, I show that you can deal with this density weight one operators, which act as finite triangulations. And I can also compute the commutator algebra, and one can also there see for the first time that the commutator algebra mirrors the classical one. So even though
you want to the last statement, the commutator algebra.
The commutator algebra, yeah.
Yeah. So something about the classical one.
I'm taking the density one operators, Hamiltonian constraint, and also a density weight one diffeomorphism constraint, and I compute the respective algebra at the on the kinematical Hilbert space, and I find a commutator which I can now, because in PFC, I have full control over the spectrum of the inverse volume. I can actually carry out this calculation, and I get an operator which on the right hand side, which qualifies as quantization of the classical Poisson rest.
Okay.
So the last thing I wanted to say is that it's a little bit pessimistic, maybe in spirit, but let me say it anyway. One thing we have to when we want to try to see what we have learned from PFC in application to LQG, then it should be noted that much of this could not have been done if we didn't know what the exact solution was. I think this is a fair statement. And to begin with, it's even more crucial to observe that it was very crucial to not only to have, so to say, the right factoring of the constraints, but also to start with the correct kinematical algebra of operators. So the light cone coordinates are very crucial in all of this business. So what I pull out from all of this is most importantly that maybe we should go back all to the beginning in LQG and reconsider the choice of kinematical operators that we want to base our quantization on.
Yes.
So that's all.
Yes, thanks a lot, Thomas. That's a nice complementary kind of thing to what I talked about.
Yeah, exactly.
We can talk more on Skype.
Okay.
Other questions?
Yeah, I'm a little confused about a couple of points. The first is, so Thomas, you're saying that just with density one operators, A,
yes.
You can have the kinematical Hilbert space, and B, D, that in fact you get the correct algebra.
Right, up to some, what I call a soft anomaly, some different, so in all of this, if you do it, you have to use, in some sense, a rule that assigns somehow what we would call a loop attachment and loop quantum gravity to a given graph. So now you invent this rule, and you fix it, and you have this rule, and now you compute the commutator. The operator that appears on the right-hand side may differ from, on a given graph, may differ from the rule that you have invented by something, but this something is killed by when you apply to a to a gauge environment space.
I see. So it is not exactly the same as what Madhavan was saying, that because in Madhavan's case, you get to
because of the discontinuity of the representation. So we cannot take this limit, and we don't do it.
Okay, I understand that. The second thing that I'm still trying to understand what Madhavan is telling us, he's saying that, well, maybe we should look at operators which are not well defined on the kinematics of loop quantum gravity, but they are defined on the habitat, so some kind of habitat. So let's suppose the Lavrovsky-Marov habitat. But these habitats, these are just distributions, right? And so it seems to me that these distributions, I mean, if you have an operator which is well defined on the distributions, won't you also get an operator which is well defined on the kinematical space? Because just by dual action, I'm missing something here. Something very trivial, something very simple.
No one. Thomas, do you have anything to say? I'm just a bit slow thinking, so.
No, of course, I am surprised with this, but now I think it's very, very important so the topologies of convergence are completely different. Maybe that's an easy way of saying it. Suppose you want to define the operator in kinematic Hilbert space, you discover it doesn't work in the topology of kinematic Hilbert space. Then you use the topology that somehow uses the habitat space, and you get convergence, and then you can dualize this action again, maybe to get a different operator on the kinematic Hilbert space. But certainly, that's not the same as doing the limit directly, which doesn't exist.
I agree, but I think the question is really at the end point. There should be an operator which is in the kinematic Hilbert space also. So it is not as dramatically different as one might first think. I agree that, so what one is saying is that, quote unquote, in the regularization steps, we had to go on a larger space and do something which is well-defined, which has a well-defined limit in this larger space. But then it seemed to me that one should be able to get back to the kinematic Hilbert space. Okay, this is my second question.
The thing that I don't understand about this is that we consider, at least I'm puzzled about it, I have to think about it. If I take this rescaled diffeomorphism or Hamiltonian constraint and take the limit which doesn't exist on the kinematic Hilbert space, don't I quantize an operator which actually doesn't have a classical limit? Maybe this is a question to Madhavan.
So I'm still trying to see I can't seem to agree with what Ahoy is saying. So even if I do have an operator which maps distributions to distributions, I really don't see why it should be a consistent operator on the kinematic Hilbert space. But maybe I'm just being dense. But as far as Thomas's question goes, it's true that you do not have an operator on the kinematic Hilbert space, right? You can't take the delta going to zero limit. But uh, the, once you put in the dual action, there really is no problem. And I think somehow maybe there's a mental block about this, but I think this is really one important outcome of this. And one can do the same thing, I think, for the spatial diffeomorphisms in LQG. It's just the fact that you look at the dual action. The dual action has got a more controlled behavior in the small parameter delta. And one can actually take the delta going to zero limit. There's absolutely no problem. There is no in principle reason why this shouldn't happen. So I think this is also related to Abel's question. And the problem is I really don't see Abel's argument. So I don't see that just given an operator on some space of distributions, how one could then infer that there is also an operator on the kinematic Hilbert space. And I think these two points are related, your question and Abel's statement.
Okay, the second is that both of you mentioned that there are some similarities and differences with the mu bar or improved dynamics of loop or cosmology. Can you say what they are? I mean, similarities, I think I understand, in the sense that the holonomy operator depends on the state you're talking about, depends on the labels of that state and so on. Maybe there's something more deep than that, so that would be good to know. But I would also like to understand the differences.
So this really stems from this work in progress with Alok. So over there, what one finds is the idea there is that we should look for a definition of the curvature in such a way that the E dot F minus the appropriate Gauss law term actually gives you the action of the infinitesimal diffeomorphism on the habitat. And if one looks at what sort of an F could do this, then the first thing is, of course, the choice of little loop has to be aligned with the edge of the spin network you're acting on. This is what Jorge and I think Bernie said long ago. But then there are a whole sum of terms. The zeroth order term, if I just count in terms of the little area of the loop, the lowest order term is just the curvature which we use currently. And then there are terms which depend on the triad and the holonomy. And one can write down actually an existence proof, and one can, I think, write down a recursion relation which will enable you to compute what the expression is for the curvature for any spin network state. But what I wanted to say is that if one just looks at this expression and one imagines that one was in a situation of homogeneity, like in say Friedman, Robertson, Walker, would one get terms for the curvature which look similar to what you use in LQC? And the answer over there is no. In details, you don't seem to get that. And that is what I meant by saying that there were differences.
But it seems to me that, maybe I'm wrong here, but what you get is basically, if you have some J label, that you get terms which correspond to J and lower until 1/2. Is that correct? Is that the difference you're talking about? I mean, you don't get just 1/2, but you get J and...
Not only that, but even for, I think even aside from this, if I just thought of the E's and the... So what I can do is I can think of the E's and the A's to be homogeneous. And whatever expression, I have an expression in terms of holonomies and triads. And now I can just pretend that the holonomies and triads come from some homogeneous connection and triad. And I can write down some expression, and I can expand the expression you have written down and try and compare them. And I think beyond just the fact that there is this J dependence, I think there are differences beyond that. But beyond that, I can't say, because the work is still in progress and we have to write things down completely.
Thank
so it's not only the J, but in actual fact, but I don't think that this is at all disturbing because of two reasons. I mean, one is that if everything works, what we have done is we have found an expression for the curvature, which gives you a nice diffeomorphism constraint. But Of course, in some sense, the components of the curvature which go into the diffeomorphism constraint are distinct from the components of the curvature which go into the Hamiltonian constraint. So that is the first difference. And the second difference is that I don't know really how you would imagine LQC coming from LQG, and there would be some, I think, some cost draining and averaging, etc., over fundamental LQG states, and that also could result in these differences. So,
I agree that there is no pure tangent, but what I just was trying to understand is some detail. Thank you.
More questions? Okay, if there's no more questions, let's thank Madhav again.